impeachment inquiry against President Trump, a lawsuit against Indiana's Medicaid work requirement, plus Connie Lawson on election security money, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending September 27th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world. Working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced the launch of what many in her party have long advocated for, an impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump.
I'm announcing the House of Representatives moving forward with an official impeachment inquiry.
Pelosi's historic move comes after controversy over a phone call Trump had with the newly elected Ukrainian leader in July and reporting that the president pressured him to investigate political rival Joe Biden.
The president must be held accountable. No one is above the law.
Trump has called the allegations against him ridiculous and a witch hunt. In a recap of that phone call released by the White House, Trump notes at the outset that, quote, we do a lot for Ukraine. He asks Ukrainian President Zelensky about a, quote, favor, later going on to tell him, quote, I would like you to find out what happened with this whole situation in Ukraine and the Bidens. Indiana's congressional delegation is split along party lines on the impeachment inquiry. What now? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, does the formal launch of an impeachment inquiry really change all that much?
Oh, I think we have a qualitative change here. I mean, we've always known that this administration is corrupt, and we know it's incompetent, and we know that the president lies habitually. But this is the first time that you have it from his lips to a leader of a foreign country asking for a, quote, favor, unquote, to dig up or manufacture dirt against the son of a potential opponent. That's easy to understand. That violates so many different laws, it's difficult to enumerate them all. And it's very easy for voters to understand. So we've had a qualitatively different approach, and the White House recognized that, because the White House went to cover it up right away. The staff people understood that what they had in their hands there was radioactive. And we don't know how many more of those radioactive bombs have been covered up by the White House based on the contacts that the president or the vice president has had with foreign leaders. So I think this makes it completely different. This is the kind of activity that you expect from thugs or from organized crime. You don't expect it from the president of the United States, and it cannot go without being tried.
What hasn't changed is the political makeup of Congress. So while Democrats have a majority in the House and already have enough people who support at least the inquiry and probably impeachment, you certainly don't have those numbers in the Senate. So in that sense, does this change anything?
I don't think Democrats have any credibility on the impeachment argument because they've been calling for it on any number of issues since practically Inauguration Day. And so the fact that they may think this is the most credible doesn't change the fact that it's politically irrelevant. And they haven't formally started an impeachment proceeding because the impeachment proceedings throughout U.S. history have begun with the House voting to instruct the Judiciary Committee to begin that proceeding, to outline the terms of the impeachment, the scope of what the Judiciary Committee must investigate. And Nancy Pelosi doesn't want that vote because it's going to be completely partisan, unlike previous votes, which further undermines the fact that this is a political effort. I do like the fact that this is the most Democratic Party thing ever, that the one impeachment issue they pick indicts their own front runner, who's running on electability and the ability to beat Donald Trump, because you can't talk about a call to the Ukrainian leader from Donald Trump without also talking about Joe Biden and the fact that his son was under investigation for working for a company that Joe Biden was involved in.
Hunter Biden did anything wrong. And are you defending what the president did? Do you think what he did with the leader of the
Ukraine is the right thing? We'll let Brandon ask some questions here. Thank you very much.
You don't want to answer that question, do you, Michael?
On to you, John.
No, I do want to ask this question. Republican elected officials are going to be asked exactly what Ann just asked. Are they going to be in a little bit of trouble having to answer it?
Absolutely.
I don't think so. Look, I don't think if Democrats had not talked about impeachment and they had just opposed what Donald Trump has done from a policy standpoint or from a character standpoint or from a performance, his performance in office, then they'd have a lot more credibility than jumping from Stormy Daniels to name your issue to now a call to the Ukrainian leader.
It's kind of hard that to no pick, one can though. Prove. There are so many.
So to this end, I want to ask about the sort of political question, which is, presuming that Donald Trump is still running for re-election in 2020, and that right now there's no reason to think that's not true, does this...
We're going to start that rumor, though, here
yeah,
now.
Right.
Let's see.
How does this impact his chances at re-election? Does it really change it?
I think it improves it. If Elizabeth Warren's in the driver's seat.
In an odd sort of way, it might benefit him in one way. And your point was right on target, Brandon. That is that the makeup of Congress is not going to change. So, in all likelihood, after some sort of investigation, chances are we will see an impeachment vote, and it will prevail in the House. Barring huge surprise, he will not be convicted in the Senate. So basically, it will be the Bill Clinton scenario. And I'm not trying to equate the two, but remember, Bill Clinton actually had a bit of a bump with his core constituency, with the faction that said, hey, they're trying to mess over our guy
different.
And the election. I acknowledge that up front. I'm just saying the political realities here. I'm not saying what's right or wrong. And then if, in fact, the Senate vote goes that way, he can say, as he did with the Robert Mueller report,
I've been vindicated.
And again, right. There's no appreciation for nuance in any of this, but when you paint in broad strokes like that, that's the approach.
Let me ask the political question from this angle, which is, does this roll downhill at all between now and next November in either direction?
I think it depends. I mean, we now have the whistleblower complaint, which does a couple things. It identifies some other people that could be witnesses. It kind of depends if there's more of an investigation to what we see. It'll also be interesting where Mike Pence falls in all this. He's obviously standing by his man, so to speak. But, you know, he did encourage the president not to release that call. So, I mean, we'll still see how he falls out in all this.
We'll see. And we'll see what the senators who don't vote to impeach
No guarantee there will even be a vote in the Senate, though, to be honest.
Well, that may be. But even so, then you say you didn't
or in the
stand
House.
Up.
Look,
that's
you
true. There's no guarantee
there's
there will
no
be a
guarantee
vote
in the House.
The reason Nancy Pelosi has not put this to a vote yet is because she knows that her members in swing districts that took them from GOP seats.
It was the members in swing districts.
This is not popular in those
districts. It was the members in swing districts who did the letter to the editor asking for the impeachment inquiry because they think this conduct is so egregious.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, how will the impeachment inquiry impact President Trump's re-election chances? A, it helps him, B, it hurts him, or C, it will have little to no effect. Last week's question, who will be the Democratic nominee for governor in 2020? 28% of you say Woody Myers, 47% say Josh Owens, and 25% are wondering if it'll be somebody else. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. A new lawsuit is challenging Indiana's work requirements for the state's Medicaid expansion program, HIP. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan has more.
Medicaid work requirements have been struck down in three other states. Indiana's Gateway to Work program launched at the beginning of this year, and people had to start reporting work, school, or volunteer hours in July. HIP members will be required to report 80 hours a month by January 2020. There are a number of exemptions, including caregivers or medically frail individuals. In a written statement, Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb says Indiana's program is different. He says it includes, quote, supports and pathways to ensure Hoosiers can easily skill up, volunteer in their community, or get a better paying job.
Mike O'Brien, are these work requirements in jeopardy?
They could be. I mean, the other states did thrown out, but were thrown out or were stayed. But Indiana structured its program much differently. It gave a lot more flexibility in how you actually meet the requirements. It gave a much longer run-up and education effort for compliance so that people in this program could work. Philosophically, I think this is something, if you look at the Medicaid program in general, it's not pregnant women and children anymore that we're making go to work, right? Or the disabled, or the elderly, or dual eligible people for Medicare and Medicaid. It's working people, and if we've got major party candidates for president right now calling for Medicare for all or a full expansion of Medicaid to the entire population. And if that's going to be the case, I don't think it's unreasonable from a policy standpoint to say, if you're going to get this free benefit or this taxpayer-paid benefit, then you ought to put something back in, whether it's community service, go volunteer, or go get a job for 20 hours a week and give back that way. If we're going to continue to go this direction where government-provided health care continues to expand. And it's not the old vulnerable populations anymore when people think of, oh my God, we're making people on Medicaid go to work. What are we doing?
Indiana's, Mike points out, there are a lot of different ways you can meet this requirement. You don't necessarily have to get a job. It's job training. It's volunteering, things like that. Do all of those options make this more palatable?
Barely. Okay. You know, every time I get Republicans...
You got to win. I think I'm counting that as a win.
Every time I get Republicans wanting to do something for the poor people, I want to lift up the cover to see what's there. You're talking about 100,000 people, and you're going to establish an entire bureaucracy to monitor it, okay? That money would much better be put to other purposes, like, for example, raising the minimum wage so people have incentive. Where's the market force at work here? We have the lowest unemployment we've had, and yet we can't raise the minimum wage to make it attractive for people to try to find work. Instead, we want to harass them because, God forbid, they get sick and we have to pay for it. And you know what happens with this? When they're off the Medicaid, they're off the Medicaid, their hypertension and diabetes get out of control, and guess where they go? To emergency rooms. And guess what? It costs us more. So every time the Republicans try to do something, all they're trying to do is to basically slap people who are now poor and sick down. And I'm getting a little tired of it, frankly.
These other states who've had lawsuits against their programs, the governors in those states, the legislatures who may have approved them, have faced a lot of scrutiny over that. That we haven't seen that here at all, have we?
No. The rollout has been extremely quiet, a few stories here and there. I think that is partially because of the large number of exemptions or ways you can fill it. And I think we're getting to the point where a lot of sort of average folks out there think, yes, maybe your current job doesn't work, but there's so many jobs out there that need to be filled, and it's only 20 hours a week. We're not asking them to, work 60-hour weeks and not be able to raise their family or anything.
There are a lot of people who are injured or whatever who haven't qualified for Social Security disability, which is really tough to do, and aren't in a position to work. And even if they work, they're going to be working for $7.25 or maybe $8 or $9 an hour without benefits.
Does the argument Mickey just made, the idea of all of the different ways you can qualify, you don't have to work a full-time job in order to continue to get these benefits, does that help Eric Holcomb in the court of public opinion as he runs for re-election over the next 14 months?
It probably does for the reasons that Nikki spelled out. That's the notion that sort of the Hoosier common sense philosophy that you don't get anything for free, you got to have some skin in the game. I mean, that's...
Yes, we do love that phrase here.
Again, So that's...
So healthcare is not a right. It's a privilege.
I'm telling you the realities of it. I'm not telling you my opinion. As a practical matter, our opinions don't matter. And frankly, Hoosier voters' opinions don't matter. The U.S. district judge who will be hearing this matters. And it happens in all likelihood to be the same judge who decided the Arkansas, Kentucky, and New Hampshire cases. Now, if you read what he ruled in those cases, it wasn't about how nice the state was or how mean the state was. It comes down to whether it was basically a thumbing of the nose, basically at the statute the statute that created the Medicaid program. So it really doesn't. If that's what upon which the pendulum upon which this hinges for him, it doesn't matter if someone shows up at your house and drives you to your job. It's still problematic from that
standpoint. Yeah, it's a very technical legal argument.
Now, and that all may be rendered moot by the U.S. Court of Appeals, which is hearing two of those other three states' appeals at the urging of the Trump administration.
Right, it probably won't be Indiana's case that decides this.
Right, so, but what I guess I'm saying, judges matter more than we do in this, our opinions.
They
generally do.
Secretary of State Connie Lawson says Indiana legislators wouldn't provide funding for election security measures at the level she wanted, though she says Hoosiers should still have confidence their votes are secure. About two-thirds of Indiana counties use electronic voting machines that experts say should include paper audit trails. The General Assembly this year appropriated $10 million in the new state budget for election security, which will pay to add those paper trails to just 10% of the machines that need them by next year. Lawson says she initially asked budget writers for more money.
But they told us to get real. So we got real, and we tried to hone it down to where it was possible to get the dollars.
It will be a decade before all Indiana voting machines that need paper trails get them unless counties move forward on their own. Nikki Kelly, this is the first, we've been talking about this issue for several months now, since really this session. This is the first time that Connie Lawson has said she wanted more money than lawmakers would give her. Does that change the discussion around this issue?
I don't think so, ultimately, because I think that's how the budget system basically works. I bet every single agency went to them wanting more money, and they have to reel back the requests and be more realistic. I mean, heck, they didn't even give DCS what they wanted, so certainly aren't going to give that. But I do think the real question is, once we realize we have all this extra money, like, why didn't we throw some extra money at making these machines correct or more secure for this year instead of, building the swine barn for out of cash instead of bonding?
Yeah, is it fall less on lawmakers who wouldn't find room in the budget for this and a billion other things, or is it more on, well, why aren't we using some of the $400 million surplus that we got?
It's a mix. There are some lawmakers who probably doubt that there is any threat to the sanctity of our elections anyway, so they think this is,
Overblown.
Then you have those who just look at the demands and the pressing nature of so many things in this state. You know, do you guard against something that, okay, even if we acknowledge that there were problems, do we spend a lot of money to guard against that to the nth degree, or do we take a step in that direction and deal with some of the other pressures, financial pressures and challenges we face as a state? And then I think you have a fair number who are just still holding on to the hope that the feds, come in over the mountaintop riding the horses of rescue, and that they deliver federal funds. I mean, the state already, I believe she already has about $7.5 million in federal grant money that
she's using all of it.
But I think there are people holding out on the federal government saying, don't worry, states, we got you covered on this front.
Connie Lawson has pointed out more than once that the companies who make these for Indiana literally couldn't make enough to put on every machine that needs one by 2020. But I'd bet they could get to like half, and that's $40 million, which is about what we spent on the swine, or what we're going to spend on the swine barn. So, again, does that not reflect well on Governor Holcomb's priorities?
I think there's a lot going on here. I think it's a mix of people disagree that there was any evidence that the election was literally tampered with, that the machines in Marion County or Hendricks County, Indiana, or wherever, were at risk or tampered with. There's production issues on actually delivering these machines. And we forget the fact that we talked about all these election issues at the national level, and we forget that we're also asking 92 county clerks in Indiana and 92 county councils and 92 counties commissioners to actually do this and actually get this done in time for May, which is a real lift. And we forget in the national conversation that elections are still run locally. They're still largely run by volunteers. And there's not buy-in on that the paper trail is the secure option anyway. Some auditable back-end way to go find out how you voted.
Is that fundamentally here the biggest issue, is that we still can't all agree on what exactly we need?
No. Everybody agrees that having a paper trail is preferable, because there was evidence of the Russians trying to get into each state system. So there was evidence.
I'm not saying that they changed
the outcome, but we have 4 years elapsing too, and who knows how much better they've gotten. And by the way, Marion County has a paper backup, which is why they're not at risk. But what you have with this is an unwillingness. They think that the state's a bank, okay? That's what they think, that they collect this money and they hoard it and they say, look at how great we are because we've got all this money in the bank. And there are these pressing needs. And I think the sanctity of the election is a pretty darn pressing need. And we know it can be addressed. And you know what? If there's enough money to pay for those machines, I bet you they can get done. They may not get done by the primary, but they can certainly get done by the general election.
All right. Well, Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill says he supports a proposed multi-billion-dollar settlement with drug maker Purdue Pharma. More than two dozen state attorneys general and more than 2,000 cities nationwide reached a tentative settlement with the OxyContin maker, accused by many of playing a major role in the country's opioid abuse epidemic. In a statement, Curtis Hill's office says the deal would hold Purdue Pharma and its owners, the Sackler family, directly accountable, and that the money will flow to the people who most need it. Hill's statement says the alternative is an uncertain and likely lengthy legal battle. but a couple dozen other state attorneys general opposed the deal, decrying it as woefully inadequate.
John Schwanis, is it better to just take the money and run, or hold out for more?
If I knew how to answer those questions, I'd probably be at the casino right now, making a lot more money than I am here. This is a tough one. I don't know that you can really assign a lot of political motivation here. I will say that there are a lot of theories going around. If you look at how attorneys general across the country have broken down on this issue, it's, like everything else in our country, about 50-50 it seems to be split. I think 20 or so are supportive. You have 24, 25, a couple dozen that are against.
It is almost 50-50.
Now, they do tend to, if you look at them and you line them up, they do tend to be Republicans for, Democrats against, with two exceptions in each, two other switches. Now, there's been reporting suggesting that there had been, large contributions and support that Purdue Pharma and members of the Sackler family behind the company had done with the Republican Attorney General's Association. But then they've also given to a lesser amount to the Democratic counterpart to that. So I suppose you can find what you're looking for. But the reality of this is, we saw this week also that if, in fact, as part of the bankruptcy proceedings that Purdue Pharma is going for, they've said that as part of the bankruptcy proceedings, there's not basically a blockade put up against other state lawsuits by attorneys general who don't support this,
right,
that there might not be any money to pay the $3 billion that's spelled out in the settlement.
Does that play heavily into this?
I'm sure it does. And to be honest, I don't think I'm qualified to know. I don't know the details of what this settlement would be. I think we do know that if they turned it down, it would be a protracted 10-year battle over this forever. So when you're looking at, a bird in the hand versus maybe what you might get in the future, I don't see it as completely out of the realm to take it.
Yeah, this is not the states and the federal government going after the cigarette companies. First of all, it's one company, and they're in bankruptcy already. So is it best to just get what you can right now?
Well, it depends on whether or not you could pierce the corporate veil and go after the family whose assets are still out there and not insignificant by themselves. So you don't know whether taking the money and running or suing is the right way, and you won't know until this is over. It's interesting to me that he always finds litigation that advances his religious agenda and backs away from other things. So I don't know whether he's doing the right move or not, and we won't know for several years.
Is that the biggest problem, is that we just can't know for a really long time until all of this shakes out?
Yeah, I mean, people keep comparing this to the tobacco settlement, master settlement agreement, which is still being paid out over 20 years later, right? But that's because those companies continue to exist. They continue to manufacture a product, and they continue to sell that product and continue to fund that.
Make a lot of money.
Fund that settlement that way, and that's not the case here.
All right, well, a new report from Chalkbeat shows some Indiana schools may be artificially increasing their graduation rates by masking dropouts as students transitioning to homeschooling.
Chalkbeat's report looked at 2018 student data from around the state. It found that more than half of the 3,700 Hoosier students recorded as moving to homeschool were in just 61 of the state's 507 high schools, schools where the ratio of those leaving to homeschool to students earning diplomas was much higher than the state average. Chalkbeat says those numbers suggest the state's method for calculating graduation rates and its, quote, lax regulation of homeschooling is obscuring dropout issues at some Hoosier high schools.
Mike O'Brien, will this prompt greater oversight of homeschooling?
Maybe not homeschooling initially, but I think it will prompt greater insight into how we define a student dropping out, how we define a student transitioning to homeschool, and I think we're clearly not serving these kids who are dropping out with no intent to be homeschooled. The mom in the start of this article said, well, how am I going to homeschool this kid, right? I mean, this is a poor family on South Side of Indianapolis. She's like, I had no plans to homeschool. What are you talking about? So clearly that needs to be uncovered.
Yeah, how deep should this should any reform out of this go?
Well, I think where you start with this is you look at the for-profit entities that are cooking the data to make themselves look better so they keep getting state funds. It's not the homeschooling as much as it is these for-profit groups.
There were more schools than just the charter school at USC.
That's right. But there were, but the bulk of them, the bulk of them were also for-profit institutions, like the one that was featured in the Star article was one taken over from IPS because the state says we've got to give these to for-profit.
Right.
And that's part of kind of a larger movement here in terms of maybe we need to start taking a little closer eye on these charter schools.
Maybe.
Well, no. That point's important because if you've got 61 schools, but two of them were run by for-profit and they were takeover schools, so DOE is in there doing the doing the data on that
piece.
So
we should have been able to keep
them. But the other 59 presumably were public schools that do their own reporting, and the department doesn't look at that data.
They just get it.
They just plug it into the accountability formula. Right.
Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.